Hello, fellow Ag Nerd. My name is Tim Hamrich, and every week you and I get to hear from the founders, farmers, innovators, and investors shaping the future of the ag industry. Now, I considered a title for this episode that was something along the lines of the biological revolution coming to agriculture. And obviously, I decided against it, not just because it's overdramatic and the word revolution is tossed around way too much in this industry, in my opinion, but also because it would give many listeners the wrong idea of what this episode is about. This is not an episode that's about biologicals, which has become sort of the catch-all term for biostimulants, biopesticides, biofungicides, and bioherbicides. We're going to talk about those things here today, but I'm just not a fan of trying to categorize everything as biologicals. And that is for the following reasons. Number one, the term biological doesn't tell a farmer, customer, or anyone else anything about what the product will do for them. Is it effective? Is it profitable? What value does it have? In fact, in some cases, calling something a biological can be used to almost justify that it's not as effective, which brings me to point number two, which is the term biological comes with a lot of baggage. Decades of new products emerging with promises that at best don't work in all cases and at worst sometimes appear to be snake oil. Now, I'm not saying that all biologicals have been bad by no means, but I'm saying because we've lumped them all in together, the ones that haven't turned out so good have really cast a shadow on those that have. Number three, some of the benefits of a quote unquote biological doesn't have the right incentives in place to actually return value to farmers. Meaning, if, for example, a biological can improve quality or boost a marketing story of how a commodity was grown, or if it can reduce emissions, how exactly does that farmer who paid for the product see that money back for their investment in it? Number four, there are products that aren't purely a biological in the pure sense, in that they're not a microbe, or they're not really a synthetic chemistry product either, but they do deliver some great outcomes for farmers. They get lumped in at times with biologicals because they just have nowhere else to go, and we just want to put things in these broad categories. We've heard this on the show about like Sound Agriculture Source product, you know, for example, that uses chemistry to improve the performance of natural microbes in the soil, or like Vestaron that has a peptide product for pest control. Today, we're also going to add a natural chemistry company to that list in Heart Bio, which uses formulations from plant extracts for a suite of bioherbicides. They're one of the companies. They're one of the four companies that you'll hear from today. And number five, and I'll get off my soapbox after this, I promise, the entire industry is looking for ways to reduce reliance on synthetic chemistry, whether that's due to resistance, regulation, cost, or other factors. So, you know, classifying something as a biological is just becoming less and less of a differentiator. It's kind of like, okay, yeah, but so what, right? Anyway, all of that said, I wanted to do this episode because I do believe that advancements in biotechnology have the potential to be the single biggest impact of any technology on the future of agriculture. That's my opinion. And that's what I want to talk about here today in this episode, as we highlight four companies that are doing some fascinating work driven by biology and that I had the chance to sit down with for conversations at World Agritech this year. And now, driven by biology is the important part there. These are not all biologicals companies. One's natural chemistry, two or more genetics, and then one is more what I would consider your traditional biological in that category sense. But as I said, I'm hoping that that category just goes away. We could start talking about individual products and their individual merits. But first, I want to take just a moment to thank our quarterly presenting sponsor, which this quarter is Headstorm, engineering growth for the farms of tomorrow. Headstorm is a full-service technology consultancy with been there, done that knowledge and expertise in the ag industry. The team at Headstorm knows which digital strategies work and which ones don't work based on the competitive landscape across broadacre, specialty, and animal ag industries. Realize your business objectives through innovative solutions and focused product strategy. Swiftly bring ideas to life from proof of concept to MVP with elite product strategy and engineering. Headstorm provides a holistic and actionable technology roadmap that bridges the gap between strategy and implementation. From inception to execution, they help you play to your strengths, mitigate your weaknesses, and make technology your unfair advantage. Learn more at headstorm.com. That's headstorm.com. I'll leave a link for that in the show notes. And thank you to Headstorm for supporting Ag Innovation and the Future of Agriculture podcast. All right, now back to today's episode. So that intro, I know it was very soapboxy and preachy. That's not usually my style, but it just kind of had some things to say today. I know it sounds, though, like I'm both criticizing biologicals and calling them the future of agriculture. So let me clarify just a little bit. My point is that we need to stop lumping everything into this biologicals category and making judgments about a vague category, and instead look at how companies and products can stand on their own merits and the value they offer to farmers and consumers, and I guess the world at large, if you want to throw everybody in there. In today's episode, I'll feature two companies in LO Life and Pairwise that are using biotechnology, specifically gene editing, to change the game on certain agricultural products and ingredients. What they can do to me is just mind-blowing. In the interview, I called them the Willy Wonkas of agriculture. I'm still not sure whether they liked or hated that reference, but I thought it was fitting. Then we'll dive deeper into New Life Symbiotics, which is more of a biological company in the classic sense of the word, in that they sell microbes used as biostimulants and biopesticides. This is going to give you a good look into some of the challenges and opportunities of these types of products. And then we'll take a peek into what Harp Bio is doing with their natural chemistry from plant extracts to provide a new suite of herbicide, bioherbicide products. Well, is it a bioherbicide? Is it not? It's natural chemistry. You be the judge. Doesn't matter what you categorize it. Let's look at the merits of the product. That's kind of my whole point here. Anyway, off the soapbox, I promise. All of these are examples enabled by the advancements in our understanding of biology, combined with things like data science and other tools that I think will continue to accelerate innovation in agriculture faster than just about anything else I can think of out there today. We're going to start with these two companies that I call the Willy Wonkas of agriculture, Pairwise and LO Life. Both are doing incredible work to genetically enhance existing food products. LO Life CEO Todd Rance calls what they do molecular farming, meaning that they identify a molecule that is, for whatever reason, in high demand, something that people want, and then they use tools to add that molecule to crops that we already grow commercially at a large scale.
At LO, we use gene editing as a tool for a lot of the work we're doing in molecular farming, but it's not the whole system for us. The tools we use with gene editing, we call it ARCUS. And what that does is essentially uses a single protein to go in and make the same kind of precision edits that we can use to change genes. We can make very precise edits that improve the crops and the traits that we're trying to develop. But ultimately, what LO is doing is running a molecular farming platform. So we're able to go recreate entire pathways that come from nature and allow us to produce the kinds of ingredients we're making. So if we go out and see something that's rare in nature, don't get enough of it from natural sources, we can recreate that exact same pathway, all the different steps to make it that you see in nature. We can put it into a crop that we can grow and scale and produce at higher levels.
Okay, but what does that look like in practice? Todd shared with me a very compelling example of taking a sweetener that's in very high demand but difficult to produce and adding that molecule to watermelons.
But our first product is a sweetener, an all-natural plant-based sweetener that comes from monk fruit in China. Monk fruit's a great example. It's hard to produce. You can't grow it anywhere else. It's very expensive, very labor intensive. You have to actually hand pollinate every flower in order to get the fruit. And then as soon as you pick it, it starts to spoil. So you have to freeze it before you take it to the Chinese factories to produce it. So not surprisingly, it's incredibly expensive and people can't reliably source it. So not a great solution, but yet all the food companies love it. They want more of it. We can take that same pathway from those Chinese monk fruit and put them into crops we can grow right here in the U.S. or anywhere else, and now produce and make that same ingredient, that same natural plant sweetener, available at a much larger scale and for an affordable price. What we've done is actually, with working with some big beverage companies and other food companies, we've chosen to put it into watermelon so we can create a super sweet juice that can get blended into all natural juices and reduce sugar. We think one of the most impactful things we can do to improve human health is actually get all this excess sugar out of our diets. And so by providing these kind of products, it's like giving artists new tools or new colors to work with. The food companies and the beverage companies, they can take something now that never existed before and start making lower sugar, all natural juices. And that's something they've been trying to do for a long time, and they're stuck. And so, of course, moms aren't giving their kids juices at the same rates that we used to when we were growing up. They think it's too sugary. Well, here's a new tool. If I can reduce sugar by 30%, but it's still all natural juice, then that opens up the segment and changes the game for them.
I just love the way he describes that as giving new colors to artists, or in this case, you know, giving the food companies access to ingredients that allow them to create new food and beverage possibilities. The capabilities Elo has with these new tools and technologies allow them to start with big questions like what should exist but hasn't been able to in the past.
For our process, it starts with what's the moonshot? What's the impact that we really want to have in the world? That's what our investors are expecting of us in this venture-backed company at Elo. We're going to have to do something that's meaningful. So we start there with what are the big problems and where can we fit in and solve some of those things? And then we go to the pain points of, okay, well, what's wrong in the industry today? Or where are the super expensive ingredients that they just can't get enough of because there's no other means to produce them? So are we strip mining forests for a particular rare ingredient, or are we doing something that's entirely unsustainable in producing certain spices or flavors that we can solve for? And not surprisingly, those things are incredibly expensive and the food companies can't get enough of them. And they could have tremendous health benefits, but just don't get used because of that. Well, we can come in and solve that problem. We can give them a supply at an affordable price and then sometimes a much better product, the natural form of it, in a way that they can do things now. And it does become that, you know, giving an artist new colors to paint with. They can create whole new experiences now with these new tools that they never had before. They're experts at creating what consumers really crave and what they want. And so now here's tools they can still do that with that are better for you. And you also improve carbon footprints and sustainability around some of these. They're all measuring that now too. And so this enables them to do more.
At World Agritech, I sat down with Todd, as well as Tom Adams. After a career at Monsanto, Tom became a co-founder and CEO of Pairwise, which uses their proprietary Fulcrum technology platform based on CRISPR to modify crops both for consumers and for growers.
We've created a set of proprietary CRISPR tools that can allow you to modify DNA in almost any way. So the original CRISPR was pretty limited in how you could modify it and where you could modify it. And we've added to that in a way that we can do pretty much anything to change a sequence in a gene. But Fulcrum is more broad. It's also the identification of the genes and the data science that needs to go behind that and the tools for developing it. So we work across 16 different crops at Pairwise and have been able to create interesting different traits using Fulcrum with all of those.
And interesting is an understatement here. He'll share a few examples of those in just a minute. At first glance, though, one might think that Pairwise and Elo Life are competitors. They're both in this space of gene editing for foods, but they actually have really complementary approaches using a lot of the same tools. Elo, though, tends to focus on this molecular farming, as you heard Todd talk about, for specific ingredients for shelf-stable foods. On the other hand, Pairwise, which is located right there in North Carolina, really close to Elo, focuses more on enhancing produce and whole foods to make them healthier, more appealing, and more sustainable.
We're focused on unprocessed foods. So we made a new type of leafy green, which has very high nutritional content, a mustard green, but it naturally tastes like mustard. So we use gene editing to remove the gene that caused that mustard flavor. So now you get a high nutrition lettuce that basically eats like a lettuce, but it has the nutrition of a kale. We're working on a proof of concept a couple of years away from market on a blackberry with no seeds in it. That also, we've been able to change the structure of the blackberry so that you can create a much denser growing system and increase the yields by 50 to 100%. Turns out a blackberry isn't a seed, it's actually a pit. So the same technology we're applying to cherries to make a pitless cherry and plan to make basically all the stoneless stone fruits, so we can eat them a lot easier and they fit into your life better.
And keeping with that cherries example, as just one example, the transformation goes beyond just making them pitless, which may seem a lot like, you know, making watermelon seedless. It's not just a feature for consumers, but for growers as well.
Our goal in cherries isn't just to make them pitless. We want to make cherry trees into bushes, which we know the genes to do that. So you could put them in hoop houses rather than growing them in the wild. So now you can grow them in areas where it rains in the summer, because if it rains on a cherry orchard, all the cherries split and you lose your whole crop. So you could broaden. So rather than just having 11 weeks a year that you have cherries out of Eastern Washington, we have cherries all year round. So I think that's something that we expect we'll have done in 10 years from now. That'll be what you get in the grocery store.
Are you seeing now why I call them the Willy Wonkas of agriculture? I mean, these are just a few of the examples. The possibilities of using CRISPR in this way really seem endless. To think that CRISPR didn't even exist a little more than a decade ago is an indication that this is just barely getting started in agriculture. But with all the possibilities here, I asked Tom if he could speak to how they decide to focus all of their resources and efforts to make progress rather than going a million different directions.
Yeah, I mean, we sort of have three different ways that we try to use our technology to create value. One is by licensing to others, and we think there's lots of room. And, you know, if people can use the base technology, the Fulcrum technology, to take on other crops like monk fruit, then that would be great. But we also then partner with companies like Bayer. We have a large partnership with Bayer where we're working with them on driving row crop productivity, so the big acre crops. And, you know, a decision that we didn't want to pursue those ourselves was simply that the structural barriers to take on the infrastructure that the Cortevas and Bayers have to sell corn on hundreds of millions of acres, corn seed to hundreds of millions of acres, it just doesn't make sense for us to invest to that. So we partner there. And then in the produce, we look sort of for analogs of things that have driven consumption. And we started with this idea that 10% of Americans eat the recommended amounts of fruits and vegetables a day. The rest of us eat about half of what we should. So we looked at what had driven more consumption, and the things that it's obvious in retrospect we look at is basically making it more convenient and more available. So breed blueberries for 60 years and you now have blueberries every day in the grocery store, 4x increase in consumption of blueberries. Get rid of the seeds and grapes, a lot more grape consumption. Get the easy peel mandarin that is now in every kid's lunch in America. It's now the dominant citrus. It didn't exist until 2013. The dominant citrus that we now have in America is this easy peel mandarin. So those are technologies that drive consumption, and that ultimately is part of our mission.
These are such compelling examples. And with the advancements in technology, you know, when you think about the blueberry example, maybe it doesn't take 60 years anymore to develop blueberries to the point where it makes sense for more consumers to eat them and apply that same principle across all sorts of healthy fruits, vegetables, and other foods. So this is all new, but it is happening. That high nutrition lettuce that Tom mentioned earlier became the first gene edited produce product to be available to consumers. But the question I wanted to ask is, will consumers eagerly adopt gene edited foods? This seems to me to be a big question given the decades of controversy around GMOs or genetically modified organisms, which are different than gene edited foods, but the difference is probably not immediately clear to the average consumer. This is a question I wanted both Tom and Todd to weigh in on.
We took our salad first before we launched it and wanted to get market feedback. So we went to several fairs around the US. We did one in Austin, Texas, one in Seattle, one in Palo Alto, and gave it to consumers, telling people it was gene edited. Very few people said, oh no, I don't want to try that, because they saw it. It's a salad. It takes away the scare factor. It's just a salad. Almost everybody that we offered it to ate it, had a really, really high intention to buy score from people. So it was like 91% of people had a high intention to buy the product. They liked it so much. Had some great pictures of their kids eating it who never ate salads before, and they love the salad, and you know, the exact kind of story you want to create about it. You know, so that is one piece. Again, we were selling it, people are liking it, and I think it'll be in the market again soon. And then the other thing that we decided was we want to be transparent. So there's no requirement to label it because it's not bioengineered. It doesn't fall under the definition of bioengineered, but we decided we should label it. So we put on the package better flavor through CRISPR. And, you know, basically, again, you got to be transparent before people ask, not after people ask. And I think that's one of the perception issues of GMOs, is that they were everywhere, but nobody knew where they were. And then you have these scare stories around it. And, you know, I think we take that on straightforward. And I'm sure you'll do that with your products, whether they might need to be bioengineered, but if they don't, I'm sure you'll label them in some way.
Yeah, I think Tom's right. He's underscoring something that's really important there, which is the consumer benefit. If you give consumers a product that they want, they crave, they see value in it, it's got better nutrition, it's got better flavor, it changes their minds on how the technology was used to create it. And gene editing is a tool that's going to enable a lot of those consumer-focused benefits. That's what's changing. Someday there will be some food that helps my hair grow back, and I'm not going to be able to stop eating enough of it, and I'm not going to care how it was produced, right? It changes the game.
I think you could even add to that, there are a couple of GMO products that have been approved in the U.S. for consumers, like the pink pineapple, which has, there's some health benefits to the pinkness of the pineapple, but that they can't grow enough of those pineapples. And even at a like $10 a pineapple price, it's Del Monte that's made that. It's pretty exciting product. There's a purple tomato that's not really exactly on the market yet, but it's had a really great following of people who want to buy it.
Yeah, and those are great examples. And we've got the banana, you know, working with Dole in a partnership with Dole to save the banana from extinction with gene editing tools, creating resistance to this fungus that's wiping out all of the banana production acres around the world. So we're able to come in now and that banana crop's going to be available. And the reason you'll be able to continue enjoying those sweet bananas, which is actually an amazing story if you think about how every country of the world, every culture almost uniformly enjoys these fruit, right? It's the same. There's not many foods you can say that about if you really count them on one hand. And so it's such an important staple, but the gene editing tools enable that. And your choice is to either not have it because it's gone or to continue enjoying it.
And I think for these reasons and others, the consumer perception of gene-edited food or even GMOs has definitely come a long way. Ella Life uses a variety of techniques, including gene editing and genetic modification, while Pairwise focuses just on the gene editing part on their Fulcrum platform technology. And after years of working with GMOs at Monsanto, Tom says the gene editing tools we have today are extremely targeted, giving them the chance to change one genetic factor without necessarily altering others.
With gene editing, it's actually been pretty interesting to me because I've worked a long time in this space, including a lot of GMO work, that we get very little surprises. So when we picked a gene and edit it, we've been really highly successful with more than 50% of the time we picked the right thing to do. And with GMO, we often would see off types, so something that we didn't expect. And really, we've got the phenotype we're looking for without off types predominantly with gene editing, partly because you're not moving the gene around to a different place in the genome. And there's all sorts of complicated biology that goes on there. We're altering it in place in a way that's just a natural mutation, really. So less unexpected. I'm sure with some of what you're doing, you still have to go through some of that characterizing many plants, as you described.
I think, yeah, what Tom's describing with our work is we have a lot of different approaches, and we use all the tools, including gene editing. When we're working in our gene editing platform, and we do this for a number of companies who just want some gene edits to be made, what we're finding is it actually improves the ability to make the traits work that you want and keep all those other things that you don't want to lose. That's the beauty of the precision. Is you don't have to go through all those years of breeding to bring the other traits back together again. You didn't lose them in the crossing process. You just go in and you can just make the one change or two changes or whatever you needed and still have the elite traits that are still present in that variety as it existed before you made those changes.
So you can see why this opens up so many possibilities for the future of agriculture using genetics and using these tools. After spending some time with Tom and Todd at World Agritech, it's hard not to agree with their thesis that these advancements are going to be a big part of the future of agriculture.
I think that's the future. It's where it's going. We can reinvent how we produce things, where we produce them, the kinds of crops we grow. All sorts of ways we've done agriculture in the past is now subject to change as we think about how to improve the kinds of ingredients we're producing, and we don't have to be limited by the ways we've done things traditionally.
And removing these limitations, as Todd said, that we've had traditionally is true not just for genetics, like you just heard, it's also true for agricultural inputs and how we can apply some of the same fields of study, some of the same areas of technology to the future of ag inputs. And this is what people traditionally think of when you talk about biologicals in agriculture as biological inputs, right? The problem, as I stated earlier, is that biologicals has just evolved into this catch-all term and is mostly in reference to the fact that the product is in some way biologically derived, or at least not generally synthetic chemistry. The first definition that I got when I Googled biological input is, quote, agro-industrial products or processes developed from enzymes, extracts from plants or microorganisms, microorganisms, macroorganisms, secondary metabolites, and pheromones, which are intended for biological control, end quote. Clear as mud, right? But that's sort of my point. The story with these products has to be what they can do for customers and why that's better than the alternatives, biological or otherwise. Shane Thomas, in fact, just recently wrote about the biologicals category in his newsletter, Upstream Ag Insights. I mean, he's written about it a lot, but recently made the point in response to an AgFunder article featuring a report that called biologicals economically unfeasible. And Shane rightfully made the point that, and this is Shane's words here, quote, being precise in how we talk about biologicals is crucial to have a constructive conversation about biologicals. So he's sort of making this same point that I'm trying to make here in today's episode. And I've noticed this a lot in ag tech, which is the more we generalize, the easier it is to criticize. And of course, social media has made this horrible because, you know, all you have to do is say a really general critique of a really general category and you get people that are happy to hop on because their feet can't be held to the fire with actual evidence because their point is so general. Anyway, if we lump everything together as a biological, sure, we can criticize it and be right in a lot of cases, even though the assessment would be completely wrong in other cases. It's frustrating, but it's just all too common. Anyway, the truth is that there are some biological products and companies making real progress, both technologically and commercially on farms. One of those is New Leaf Symbiotics, and I sat down with their president and CEO, Brent Smith, at World Agritech. New Leaf has been around for 11 years now, and most of that time, they were just focused on the science of identifying natural microbes that could have agronomic value. They specifically focus on one type of microbe called pink pigmented facultative methyltrophs, or PPFMs.
We are a biological company focused on a specific class of microbes called PPFMs. They're pink pigmented facultative methylotrophs, which is why we don't call them that. We call them PPFMs. And they do a lot of things, but they do them in specific ways, meaning each strain is naturally good at something, either biostimulant, biocontrol, nitrogen use efficiency, PGR qualities, so plant growth regulator qualities. So each strain is naturally good at those things, but what we do is we optimize them to be better at the things that they're naturally good at, and then apply those to various crops for different outcomes.
And to give you just a little bit more of an idea of the work that they've done to get to this point 11 years later, New Leaf has sequenced 6,500 of the 12,000 PPFMs that they found, and they have over 220 patents. And we'll get into more of what the use cases are for these products in just a minute. But I was curious as to why PPFMs. And Brent's answer to that question also provided a little bit of insight into how a biological company like New Leaf can differentiate themselves from others trying to do essentially the same things.
PPFMs are literally found on every plant around the world. They're on your grass that you walk on. It's on the trees in your yard. It's on the salad you eat. We harvested our PPFMs from various conditions, various plants. And so a lot of our work was really around, well, the early work was really around, you know, what strain is good at what. And so we have a library of 12,000 strains, 6,500 of them have been sequenced. And we then put that data into our own prescriptive biologics knowledge base. It's a database. It's not AI, but it helps us predict which strains will be good at delivering different outcomes. And so you do that, and then you go to work on how do you grow this microbe, then how do you produce it? And our production is fermentation and spray drying. And we had in the early days, well, not even that early days, even in the last 5 years, we would be up to 60% failure rate on production. We're now at last year we were at 97% success rate. And so the populations are higher, we're cleaner, we're not getting contaminated. So we've just gotten better at producing and understanding these microbes. So I guess the benefit of being an 11-year-old startup is you really get to know your technology.
Which makes sense, and that's a cool part of their story. But the whole point here is to not focus on the technology and instead focus on the value to the customer, to the farmer in their case. So how exactly then are these PPFM products being used?
So I'll start with biostimulants. Those are the first ones that we launched. And we've been now commercial 3 years. And we'll be on about 11 million acres this year. We were on about 3.5 the year before. We actually started in row crop, which is a little unusual for biologicals. A lot of times they start in and have better adoption in specialty. We went row first. We'll go into specialty. And so what the biostimulants do is they create a better, healthier plant. So better root systems, a healthier plant that then really is focused on providing better yield. And I think biologicals, the evolution of biologicals really started with yield was sort of the thing you were going after. Today, I kind of believe yield is sort of table stakes. And so in addition to that, what we're doing is we're looking for quality components. So I'll give you an example of that, where we did some work with silage feed. So let's say silage corn. But we did it then all the way down, traced it to the dairies, where these dairy cows were eating that feed. Not only were we able to increase the yield of the silage corn, that's great, that's what a biostimulant should do, but we were able to improve the digestibility of that feed in the cow and ultimately produce a higher yield in milk production. So that's what I call sort of quality. And then quantity is, or quantification is, how do you measure, report, verify impact around soil, water, air. And so, you know, we're also measuring across all of our products and technology platforms. They're all PPFMs, but different modes of action, what that soil, water, air impact could be, particularly soil and water, maybe a little less air. And then maybe finally, our corn rootworm EPA registered bioinsecticide that we launched this year, that will be commercial this year, is we have proven mode of action there, and we did a lot of work last year. It's ISR, it's induced systemic resistance. And so we don't actually kill a rootworm. What this does is it gets applied early to either the seed or in the soil, and then it gives off a defense mechanism of the corn plant or the roots that repels corn rootworm. And so we did a lot of work with the university that proved that out. And so those are a couple of the different results that we have. We're also working on nitrogen use efficiency, when we'll work on plant growth regulators, so PGRs as well.
All right, so the quantity aspect of that is pretty straightforward, right? If a farmer produces more, they make more revenue per acre, and it's easy to look at what they spent on a product and what they got in return. Other quote-unquote value propositions for biologicals in general can be more difficult to assess. For example, in the case of silage that Brent just mentioned, if the corn is more digestible and the dairy benefits from that, are they going to share that value with the farmer? Probably not. So why would the farmer pay for the input? This gets to a bigger point that I'm trying to explore further in ag tech in general, not just specific to these biological products, but in general, how do we make sure that the value and incentives are there for the person who actually has to shell out their dollars and make the purchasing decisions, which in most cases is the farmer?
It's a great point, and I don't know that I have the answer, but I've thought about this a lot, where the demands of a consumer are definitely increasing, whether it's, you know, organic, or it doesn't even have to be that, the quality of what they're getting. But then how does that translate to then the let's say the food codes that have to provide that to the consumer? And so the dairy is a perfect example. Cattle would be another perfect example. The challenge is how do you trace it and that impact? And then how do you get that value back? Ultimately, it's going to have to start with the consumer. So if you follow the value chain all the way down, the consumer will have to pay more for what they're wanting. There was actually some progress happening along that, and then inflation hit. And then the consumer wasn't as picky. And so I think eventually what you're going to have is you're going to have products on a shelf, and I'm talking food products on a shelf, that will be higher level. I think there'll be full traceability of impact and sourcing. And you've seen a little bit of that today. And that's what's going to then give the incentive for the food co's to incentivize that grower. Now, in the case of silage, and what's interesting, like, people don't necessarily think silage is and feed is sexy, but about half of silage growers are actually integrated with either beef production or dairy production. So then you already have a bit of a closed system, a couple of the steps in the value chain. And so they're reaping two benefits. They're getting their higher yield, and in the silage and the feed, they're getting the better digestibility of the cows that they own and better milk production. So they're getting value twice. And so that's why for us, it was kind of low hanging fruit, where it's an easier place for us to test something like that.
And that makes a lot of sense. In New Leaf's case, if they're selling to someone who's getting both the benefit of the yield and the benefit on the dairy, obviously they're going to capture that value and have a much better chance at a higher ROI. But this is a question I'd like to continue asking in general about agriculture, is how do we align incentives? How do we really make sure the value gets to the person who invests in it? Because it seems like there's a lot of just implied, if society benefits, then it must be a good thing, and not enough of like, who's going to pay for it? And it needs to have a clear function, a value proposition, and a return on investment. Marketers might call this product positioning. And this is definitely something that these types of products have struggled with in the past, and something New Leaf is really trying to focus on improving.
Our PPFMs do very specific things by strain, and that's what we optimize them to do. In the past, consortia was a big thing. And when you think about product positioning, what we try to do is we have a single strain for a single crop that delivers a single outcome. It's very simple to position. If you use this product, this is what you'll get. In the past, you would have a lot of consortia, and I'm not opposed to consortia, but the problem with consortia is the claims were it can do everything. Like, it can do 10 things. And what we found is with growers, and even with our partners up the value chain, they tend not to believe that you do any of those things. And then they're not willing to pay for any of those things, because you have to keep things very clear and simple on positioning, and then price it to that value for the outcome you're delivering. I think that biological companies did a disservice early on by claiming that their products did too many things. But I think also they were positioning it as a silver bullet. And I don't believe in silver bullets in agriculture. I think there's been great advancements, whether it's seed genetics or it's equipment or it's precision ag or it's crop protection or it's biologicals. There's been huge advancements, but there's not a single thing, even these great things that you can think about that's happened over the decades, there's not a single thing that is going to solve every grower's problem. And nobody knows a field better than the grower. And so it ends up being about how do you have a very prescriptive solution that's end-to-end that incorporates all of these different things. And now biologicals are more mainstream and they're getting talked about and they're being incorporated. I think that's where this needs to go. And so at this conference, I've heard a lot of people actually giving those explanations that, look, everything needs to work together. There is no thing that is going to solve all the problems. And so I think that's sort of the takeaway so far for me.
There are no silver bullets, man. If there is one theme for the 400 and however many episodes of this show I've done, it's that. And I know I take some criticism out there for, you know, in other people's words, hyping different technologies. But the fact that there are no silver bullets is exactly the reason I think we should explore these different solutions in depth, especially in a complex biological system, which a farm is. This is something, as an industry, it feels like we're wrestling with. How do we take a more systems-based approach? We understand that biological products don't just happen the exact same way that synthetic chemistry does, but we can't just buy all the products and hope that enough of them benefit the system to earn a return. Obviously, that wouldn't work. It's encouraging, though, to see companies like New Leaf trying to bridge this gap and develop products that don't pretend to be silver bullets, but can stand on their own merits and add value to customers. And I know we are just barely scratching the surface of the biological-based innovations that exist out there in agriculture. These just happen to be four conversations that I had while at World Agritech, but I wanted to highlight one more nuance on this topic before we close. Some products are not biologicals in the pure sense, meaning they're not microbes, but they do move agriculture in a more biological direction. Take, for example, Harp Bio, that uses natural chemistry, in other words, plant extracts, as an herbicide. Bioherbicides are sometimes referred to as the Holy Grail because there haven't been a whole lot of viable options in the category, and farmers are in desperate need of more cost-effective tools given resistance, regulation, and other challenges. With no new modes of action that seem to be coming from larger chemical manufacturers, Daniel Pepitone and his partner co-founded Harp Bio after years of working at BASF. Their product, which they hope will be available commercially in a couple years, uses plant extracts, mostly from mint, to create formulations that turn the natural compounds of these plants into a suite of different herbicides that can be used as pre-emergent, post-burndown, and desiccation products.
These are products that we want to work in combination with today's existing chemistries. There's wonderful technologies out there, a range of herbicides that are facing some challenges, especially around weed resistance, and what we're seeing in combination HARP plus another synthetic chemistry, we're able to fill those gaps, overcome those weed resistance challenges, and get the outcomes we're looking for. So we're still working through our development phases. We're about 2 years out from the marketplace, going to start heading towards the EPA end of this year, early next. But we really do see a viable opportunity from a marketplace perspective to be right where we need to be for a cost of goods. Kind of flip that page a little bit, think about the organic growers. Really don't have tools today in terms of actual herbicides that they can use. A lot of acid or vinegar-based formulations. This is an actual mode of action that can be fully certified organic and used on those farms, really giving them tools that they simply don't have today, fully from the standpoint of a price standpoint, really made for them, easy to do.
Daniel said their product will be used just like any other herbicide, and it's non-selective. It also uses multiple modes of action, but that doesn't necessarily mean it isn't subject to resistance developing down the road. So all the more reason to use this as one more tool in the toolbox of an integrated weed management approach.
Grasses are always harder to kill than broadleafs just by their architecture, but the chemistry is fully non-selective, meaning broadleaf grasses, we're able to formulate these things again for both pre-emergent as well as post-burndown desiccation products as well. And then working on the herbicide trait tolerant pieces to really expand into a, you know, a full weed management program using the technology. We talk to growers all the time. Recently talked to a grower out in Illinois, challenged by water hemp. He's out there waiting for the water hemp to pass the canopy of his crop so he can go ahead and wipe it down again with Gramoxone or something along those lines. Not where you want to be in terms of weed control, right? New tools are needed. They need them now as soon as we can, and more of them.
It's interesting to me that these same advancements in biology and data science and related fields is not just giving us microbes to use or genetics to use, but natural chemistry. And does that count as a biological? I don't know. And frankly, I don't think it matters, because if it works, the results will speak for themselves.
You know, we're at the place where we're really changing the dynamics of the industry. We're really moving from a synthetic chemistry world to a natural chemistry world. It's not a flip of a switch. It's going to take some time. Got wonderful tools right now in the marketplace that we need to preserve for farmers so they can continue doing the wonderful jobs that they do, but really usher along the next phase of science, the next phase of what's coming to continuously improve what we do.
All right. Well, with that, that's going to do it for today's episode. I know we tried to cover a whole lot here today, but just a few of the takeaways I hope that you're picking up from this episode. Number one is that there really are some incredible advancements happening in biology that have the potential to dramatically change the future of agriculture, and they are worth paying attention to and watching. Number two, I hope we can just avoid this temptation to lump everything into one category so that we can cast stones about what doesn't work within that broad definition. Instead, let's examine each technology, each product, each company on its own merits and the value it provides. I realize the irony in how much I'm trying to lump into this episode, but I think the point has been made of the dangers in just calling everything a biological and either writing it off or pretending like it's a silver bullet, which, as we heard, there are none. Number three, along with that, let's embrace the complexity and the nuance here. Whether it's a biostimulant, a peptide, natural chemistry, all of them have potential to be a part of a systems-based approach to farming. I think it's interesting. It's exciting. It's worth exploring. That's going to do it for today. Thank you so much to Tom Adams, Todd Rands, Brent Smith, and Daniel Pepitone all for being willing to talk to me at the World AgriTech this year. Thank you to Headstorm for being our quarterly presenting sponsor this quarter. Learn more about them at headstorm.com. And last but never least, thank you for your time and your attention. I really do not take it lightly. I'll be back next week with another story of ag innovation.